When I was in high school, history was one of my weaker subjects. There was one particular piece of the greater British history that I was very familiar with, that I was always a favourite subject, and that I learned a lot about and was very very keen on, was a character called Clive of India, Robert Clive, who started out as a kind of local wild boy in the north of England, ran a few protection rackets, and I used to recount with great delight in my history essays how he was famous for one shop that wouldn't pay up their protection money. He lay down in the street and diverted the sewage flowing down through the gutter into the doorway of the shop with his own body, as a sort of creating a barrier to steer all the gunk into the shop so that the owner would pay up. So this was a great delight when you're a schoolboy and you have boring history essays to write. At least you can have something kind of exciting and interesting and stinky to report. Anyway, Robert Clive his parents, despairing what to do with him, sent him off to India, and there he rose to power in the East India Company and went from being a humble clerk to a great sort of military leader and sort of colonial imperialist, and led to a lot of the British conquest of India and the formation of the Raj and so on. So he was quite a significant character in the British takeover and the ruling of India. And the reason why he comes to mind this week is because, believe it or not, some of you may be familiar with this, but a tortoise that was given to Robert Clive sometime in the middle of the 18th century. He left India, I think, in 1764, and a tortoise that he was given, that was his pet, died this week. So this is a tortoise that was over 250 years old, called Advaita, which is a very suitable name. It lived in the Calcutta Zoo, Advaita, which is normally translated as non-duality, but they had given it the name 180 years ago when it arrived at the zoo, meaning there is no other. So it was an incomparable tortoise. And so this was astonishing news to hear. You think of someone like Clive of India, far off in the remote past, a whole different world, a completely different era. So the tortoise that was given to him sometime about maybe 1750 was already an adult sort of tortoise. It wasn't like a little kind of inchling baby when it was given to him. It was already a sizable tortoise that had been found in the Seychelles Islands, and some sailors who'd picked this tortoise up, and some others gave them as a present to Robert Clive, who was a sort of rising star of the East India Company at that time, big figure that they wanted to make some kind of present to. So this tortoise was probably born in the 1740s, 1730s. That's the time of George II in British history. That's before even George Washington was probably out of his short trousers. Long before there was the United States of America. And this tortoise was walking around, and it died last week, this week, on Thursday. So this is a remarkable thing, that here we are. So I counted up, actually. So 9 British monarchs have come and gone since that time. George II, George III, George IV, William IV, Queen Victoria, Edward VII, George V, Edward VIII, George VI, and Elizabeth II. The whole of the, every president of the United States has been born and either has died or is still sort of carrying on. While this tortoise has been pottering around Calcutta, living either with Robert Clive in the gardens of his home, or as of the early part of the 19th century, living in the Calcutta Zoo. So this is an amazing thing. At least to me, it's amazing to live a life that is covering such a huge span. You know, so much of what we think of as our history, the whole of the Industrial Revolution that's pretty much happened, you know, since that tortoise was born. And in one lifespan, one living being, up to 2006. So, as you can probably tell, I've been pondering the life of this tortoise for a day or two, considering, you know, what's that like? You know, here we have these sort of great colonial imperialist, you know, people getting written into the history books, rising and doing their thing and causing their havoc and making their name, rising and ceasing. The empire, the Raj, has risen and ceased, all during the lifespan of this one creature. Yeah, the United States has come into being and gone from a little sort of podunk colony off in the far edges of the world to being the most powerful country on the planet. Yeah, just to contemplate what has occurred just in terms of human history during the life of that one creature. It's amazing. And then, you know, you think, well, what is the tortoise been thinking of? You know, what's life been like for Advaita? Good cabbage this year. That's April and May, you know. Well, I mean, I don't want to presume. I mean, maybe there's all kinds of interesting and profound things going on in the mind of a tortoise. But, you know, just to contemplate, you know, a lifespan that long and comparing it with our own, what would it be like to live, 250 years or to see so many changes happening around us? But then when you consider, you think, well, what would it like? What would it be like to be living that long, to have such a life, to have covered so many years? There's a famous essay I read some time ago that's called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And so it starts off with that question, what's it like to be a bat? And then, you know, just like with imagining the life of this tortoise, what we do initially is that we would say, well, you know, it must be very strange being a bat because you can't really see very well, but you kind of see with your ears. You live in this world of finely textured echoes. You know, you make these high-pitched noises and then you shape your world through the sound. The echoing of sound. What a strange thing. How would that form images that you could fly around and you know, dodge obstacles at high speed and catch little insects on the wing? How would you do that? That must be so difficult. And the person who wrote this essay, I think it was a philosopher called Nagel, you know, walks you through it and he says, well, of course, you know, what you're doing, you start off by putting your human mind and your human conditioning and your human perceptions sort of into the body of this bat, just as I found myself putting my human perceptions into the body and mind of Advaita, the tortoise. And as you walk through it, and as he sort of leads you through this kind of imaginative exercise, what you realize is that you need to start shedding your perceptions and your preconceptions, because of course, you know, you wouldn't have a human mind, any human conditioning in the body of a bat. It wouldn't be like suddenly I'm trying to be Amaro Bhikkhu flying around, steering with my ears, though I've got pretty prodigious ears. It's like I would be challenged to find my way in the dark just by using them, especially if I was flying and trying to catch mosquitoes, you know. along the way. And so when you consider it as action and you walk or fly through it, what you come to, the conclusion that you come to by the end of this investigation, the end of the essay, is what is it like to be a bat? It's really ordinary. It's completely normal, because for a bat, steering your way through life with your hearing is just what happens every day. It's normal. It's not anything extraordinary. It's just what you're conditioned to, and so that's how you perceive the world. So to a human, looking at it from the outside, thinking, wow, it must be so strange, it must be weird, having to create a world, shape a world through your hearing. But if that's what you've lived with your whole life, and that's what your whole system is geared to do, that's normal, that's the ordinary, that's the familiar. So similarly, when you what would it be like to be Advaita, the tortoise, living for 250, 260 years? When you contemplate it, you realize the answer is, it's really normal. It's very ordinary to live for 250 years. It's a normal thing. Our perceptions are such that we are always conditioned to be thinking of the rest of the world, in a comparison to us. That, the way that I see things, the way I think, my opinions, my views, they seem to be the most sort of real, and that against which everything else is measured or judged. But the more that we unconsciously carry on in that way and assume that my view, my feeling, my perception is reality, and that's the way to measure everything, then the more we find ourselves isolated, alienated, we find a disconnection in the heart. And not just between us and other species, bats and tortoises and fishes or dragonflies and birds and whatever, but more particularly just with other humans, other people. And this is something, when we reflect and consider, it's familiar to all of us. The more that I'm convinced of my view of the world is the only real and trustworthy view, the more divided, the more separate, the more alienated I am from everyone else. So, so much of Buddhist practice then teaches us to recognize that tendency, that alienating habit, the self-creating habit, that which makes I and mine, my view, my feeling, my perception, my ideas, my memories, into a solid and ultimate reality. Just recognizing that habit, getting to know, getting familiar with that self-creating habit, and seeing it, its limitation, learning to recognize its limitations, and to learn to let go of it, to open the heart to empathize, to appreciate others, to acknowledge and to allow our views, our perceptions, our impressions of things not to be clung to or be held in such a way that everything is judged against those, but to be able to see that our opinions, my feelings, my opinions, my perceptions, is only one way of seeing it. It's just one point of view. It's one version of history. Well, that laying aside of our personal perspective and opening ourselves to the feelings, the point of view, the lives of others, is basically the practices of kindness, compassion are what this is speaking of. This is addressing. that basic attunement, that kind of readiness to listen and to attend to others, to empathize with another. Now, if we try and say, if we approach this whole thing with our brain, or we try and imagine somebody else's feelings, or we try to using just concepts, put ourselves in somebody else's position, or try to think of what someone else is feeling, what other creatures are feeling. That's part of, there's a good intention there. There's a kind of skillful idea or approach. But we're never quite in tune. It's like trying to be compassionate, trying to be kind, trying to be nice, trying to be unselfish from an idealistic position. Here we have, it's a noble ideal. It's a beautiful ideal, better than sort of trying to compound selfishness and work out ways that I can get what I want more easily and damn the rest. I mean, certainly it's a lot better than that. But it's also or bound to fail in its own way. It's rather like when we chant. Those of you who are familiar with the way of chanting together with others. And I don't know if this is how people are taught to work together in a choir or in singing groups. But certainly this is the way that it functions in chanting, is that when you chant, you have one person who's the lead voice, and then whatever pitch they choose to chant at, yo so, then that pitch is called the home note. So when you chant, rather than trying to, if you like, rather than trying to replicate that note, you hear that note and then you try and make it yourself, and trying to get the right note, what you find is that you're always slightly off key or not quite with it. If it's like you have your idea what the right note is, and then you're trying to make it, trying to fabricate that note with your own voice. It's difficult to describe, but there's a difference between kind of hearing the lead voice and then trying to copy it with your own note. And there's a difference between that and if you just listen. If you listen to the note, the pitch that the lead voice is making, and you just allow your voice to go to that same pitch. So it's a difference between I am copying that note, I am following that pitch, the sort of the I am, kind of a me doing it. If there's a me trying to make the right note, then it's always a little bit off. It's always not quite perfect. There's always this sort of slightly out of tune, not quite caught up, not quite with it, not quite there. But if instead there's just a listening, just an openness to the home note, listening to that pitch, and yet it's not me trying to make the right note, but then just letting the voice respond, then you find that your voice naturally goes to that home note. And even if the home note, the pitch is varying somewhat, you find that your voice stays with it much more easily than if it's the me, the kind of the self-sense trying to steer the whole thing and replicate something that it's getting. So this is a process that's familiar to everyone who's been in and around monasteries for some time and tried to work with the chanting, that it's a strange thing, because even though you're making a sound, the rightness of the sound is coming not from your will, but from your listening. There's, along with that creation, production of the sound, there's the attunement of that sound, the harmonious quality of that sound is fundamentally based on listening, on a receptivity of receiving the home note and letting your voice resonate with that. So when we talk about compassion and developing this kind of letting go of self-view and attuning ourselves to others, empathizing with others, it's fundamentally the same way. It's rather than, oh, you're feeling like this and you have that kind of character and I think this is what you need, therefore I will provide it. You know, all of that I am, you know, I am this and you've got that and you are this way and you need this and I can do that. All the yous and I's are cluttering up the whole picture. And probably all of us have had the experience of when you're trying to be helpful or trying to be kind or trying to be compassionate or trying to do the right thing, we end up falling over our own feet, figuratively or literally. It's always a slightly clumsy, clunky complicated, awkward process. But if instead of me trying to do the right thing, me trying to be compassionate, me trying to be helpful, and me trying to be kind, if instead of that there's the quality of attunement, there's a genuine opening of the heart to the moment, to who is present, to what they're feeling, where they're at. There's a laying aside of sort of my plan or my ideal or my feeling of should. You know, I should be patient, I should be kind, I should be wise, I should be thinking of something here. We lay that aside and there's an opening of the heart. What is this? What is here? A wordless attunement, a kind of openness. Then we find that the heart responds just quite naturally, just like the voice going to the home note on its own, without me trying to do anything. In exactly the same way, when we're with another person, and there's that basic gesture of empathy, of compassion, then we find when we need to be quiet, we're quiet. When we need to be jovial, we can be jovial. When we need to be fierce, we can be fierce. When we need to be very still, we can be still. When we need to act and do something, then we do that. And if we're mindful at these times, and if you remember those kind of exchanges of yourself with others, that oftentimes it's, you know, we see that it happens before thought, you know, before we know it, and there's a me deciding what to do. We feel that quality of going very still, or reaching out to help someone, or just cracking a joke, or you know, making some kind of response. So, you know, we find ourselves almost surprised that as we're saying it or doing that, oh yeah, that was a good thing to do. Yeah, our own the compassion of the heart, the attunement of the heart surprises the thinking mind, because you know the it's operating before thought, prior to conceptual thought. It's a more radical, more basic responsivity than the thinking mind or the planning mind or the decider. Now the English word compassion, you know, it's in a way it's rigged to be misunderstood, because it literally means to suffer with. Com, from the Latin, com meaning with, and passio, suffering. So, you know, it's suggesting that we are experiencing the suffering along with another person. If another person is having difficulty or suffering, then to have compassion is to suffer along with them. But in the Buddhist psychology, it's very clear that karuna, compassion, or anukampa, is another word for it, anukampa. Is not a state of suffering. In fact, if you do experience suffering while you're trying to practice compassion, then it clearly states you got it wrong. You know, the practice has gone awry, and it's not being followed correctly. So it's a slightly different approach. So with that listening and that attuning of the heart to another, that we can open ourselves to the suffering of other beings, the difficulties of other beings, the point of view and the feeling, the kind of grief or difficulty the suffering another being has, but we are not suffering as well. And in the West, in a way, it's difficult for us because we tend to relate to being compassionate as, or in a way afraid to be compassionate because we will suffer. Although we're supposed to be suffering, that how can you be in the face of that kind of misery and not suffer? You know, culturally, we're conditioned so much in that way that how can you not be upset? How can you not weep when faced with, when if you're really open to this, if you really understand this difficulty, this dukkha, this other beings experiencing, or these beings are suffering oppression. But so in a way we have to, it's like going against a whole cultural conditioning, a whole kind of deep level of view that's embedded in our perceptions. But it's something that we can learn, and at least for myself, I found that a lot of it comes through this cultivation of listening, of using this the meditation and developing compassion around this quality of kind of deep listening, attending, and to learn how to really open to things, both the positive and the negative and the neutral, and to see that there is that place in the heart where we can truly be open to the suffering of other beings, the difficulties and struggle that they have. A genuine openness and attunement to that, a resonance with that, but without us suffering as well. We can do that. We can find that place. And this is the place that the development of karuna, anukampa, is aimed at. There's a phrase that gets translated in English as that the Buddha uses to refer to compassion, which is rendered as trembling for the welfare of all beings, which is a very compelling image. So that for that one is so concerned that other beings are happy and that don't suffer, there's a kind of quivering within us, kind of an eagerness, a concern. And but in a way, even saying trembling, it's like the fear and trembling of who was it? Kierkegaard, or one of those anguished European philosophers. even that trembling is I don't feel is quite got the right tone for it, because it's more like resonating, that there's the heart can resonate with the suffering of other beings. There can be a profound caring and concern for that. But without a nuance, without the slightest iota of suffering within ourselves generated on account of that. So that the more we find that we develop this, we are not afraid to be in the presence of others' difficulty in dukkha. We don't find ourselves pulling back from the suffering of others because of trying to sort of protect ourself, quote unquote, but there's more. The more we're able to develop this deep listening or empathizing, then the more that we can fully appreciate and be open to the difficulties, the pain of the world, and not run away from it or kind of shut down or close off or distract ourselves. It's not something that the heart needs to be protected from. You know, the Karuna is one of the Brahma Viharas. It's Appamanya. It's limitless. It's one of the limitless qualities. It's a radiance. It's not a state of misery. It's not an anguished feeling. It's an infinite radiant quality. It's also interesting, one of the words that the Buddha frequently used for the community of his disciples that we chant almost daily, the Savaka Sangha, literally means the community of listeners. Savaka means to listen, listening. The Savaka Sangha is the Sangha of listeners. And you can, often that's interpreted as those who listen to the Dhamma. But also you can reflect on it as, you know, listening to the Dhamma, not just in terms of the verbal explanation of the teachings, but listening to the reality of the world, listening to the universe, listening to your own heart, listening to the natures, the feelings, the perceptions of others. That which is attending to the whole world, to the universe. And also in that light, in the northern Buddhist tradition, the image of Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, or Guan Shi Yin in Chinese, the one who listens to the sounds of the world, is the, just as we have this image of Guanyin here, that is the mythological embodiment of compassion, the bodhisattva of compassion, the embodiment of that quality of profound caring, of resonating, trembling for the welfare of all beings. Guanyin literally means the one who listens to the sounds of the world. And so that connection between compassion and listening is embodied right there in that in the figure of Guanyin, the bodhisattva who listens, who attends. And you notice that when you see the images of Guanyin, the face, whether it's a female figure or a male figure, the face is always serene. You never see Guanyin with a kind of anguished, oh, those poor living beings. You know, Guanyin with a sort of furrowed brow and sitting in a lake of tears. You know, that it's... You get Tara is sort of born from a single tear that fell from Guanyin's eye. Maybe one tear, but certainly not an anguished howl. So one of the ways that that we can develop this quality, and I find very helpful, is just to practice, use the meditation practice of listening, just using the ordinary hearing faculty to develop that quality of more profound or inner listening. And one of the most important meditation teachings in the northern school, particularly Chinese schools, the Shurangama Sutra. And in that sutra, there is, has many different aspects to it, but one part of it is where a whole string of, I think, 28 bodhisattvas come to the Buddha, and the Buddha asks each one of them, what is the method whereby you realize enlightenment? And they describe all these different kinds of practices based on the elements, the earth element, or the air element, or the water element, or all kinds of different things. Each one has their own unique form of practice, And of the 28 bodhisattvas, the last in line is Guanyin Bodhisattva. And the Buddha asked Guanyin, what was your method of enlightenment? And then Guanyin describes this meditation on hearing. And it's the translations you get of this particular passage of describing the meditation vary from place to place. But it's generally describing a turning of the hearing inwardly, learning to listen inwardly. And one translation of it is returning the hearing to listen to the self nature, and the self nature realizes the true way. That I always found a very beautiful expression. So precisely what it means philosophically. In terms of Buddhist psychology or Theravada Dhamma, is up for debate. But it's an evocative phrase and helpful in terms of that turning the hearing around to listen inwardly, to listen to the sound of your own mind, listen to your own nature, to listen to the Dhamma, to attend to that ultimate reality of things. The ultimate reality of this moment, whether we experience that as the fundamental nature of our own mind, or the nature of the world around us, or however that is cast, it's that turning the attention around, reversing it from going out into sight, sound, smell, taste, touch in the external. Turning the hearing around, returning the hearing to listen to the self nature, to listen to the Dhamma, to that fundamental reality of the mental, the physical, the numinous, to attend to this timeless suchness, this timeless, unlocated presence, which is the Dhamma. Sanditiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation to be experienced by each wise individual for themselves. It's that turning of the hearing and listening to the presence of the Dhamma, attending to that. And so, in terms of a meditation practice, there's the particular listening to what's called a nada sound, or the inner sound, the kind of high-pitched ringing tone that we can hear in the background of our listening. But even beyond that tone, it's not just a matter of hearing listening to a sound, even if it's a refined sound, because you could say, well, it's just the kind of white noise without the machine, big deal. But I could just listen to the radio fixed between stations. This isn't liberating on its own. But it's not some sort of magical quality of that particular sound, but it's training the attention to rest in the present moment and to listen. To attend to the silence of the mind, the silence of the Dhamma, to that profound inner quality. So it's like a natural laying aside of self-concern, a laying aside of infatuation with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch externally, laying aside the fascination with thought and memory and ideation and mood, emotion. And finding that place of fundamental receptivity, of resting in that attention. And even though that might seem like a very passive mode, it's like Guanyin is the actor, the doer of good deeds. But those good deeds and that kindness, that compassionate activity, it can only be effective if it's based on that fundamental attunement. So just like in an orchestra, the orchestra can only play in tune if everyone's really paying attention to the conductor. The conductor doesn't play an instrument. But the conductor is the organizing principle that pulls all the instruments together. And if the players, the musicians, attend to the conductor, and the conductor is totally attuned to the music and is fully with it, then, you know, the beautiful music happens. So in the same way, it's training our quality of attention, training this capacity of listening, of training the mind to rest in that full attentive openness. It's like, in a way, learning to be the conductor, that silent presence that is central, energetic, attentive, but silent, not playing an instrument. And if that element is in place, if that is functioning perfectly, then all the other instruments, you know, activate in harmony together. So if we're listening, if we're attending, then we can act compassionately, we can empathize with others, we can come forth when we need to come forth, we can be responsive to the different situations around us, we can be responsive to the different people that we're with, in the different moods, the different needs that they have. There's a natural attunement to that, without, you know, thinking, oh, person A needs this and person B needs that and person C needs this and person G needs that, and kind of 3 units for you and 5.5 for you and 6 for this one and none for that one. There's no calculation going on. It's an automatic, intuitive process that's also restful. Even though it's energetic, it's restful. It's not like a me doing something to make the world right and to fix all the sorrows of all beings. There's a restfulness that's simultaneous with the activity. Just as Guanyin doesn't have an anguished, furrowed brow, also there's a composure and a restfulness in the images of Guanyin. The mythological form is one of repose as well as of infinite caring and compassion. So I will offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.